I want attacking purpose for football all the time. Now we're going to have backs against the wall and we're going to fight and we're going to fight hard. You've got to show me all the guts and all the determination you've got in your body. You've got to inspire me.
A marvellous kick. That's as good as you'll ever see. And Foot's player back in front.
I don't know about you guys, but if I see one bloke walking out of here, give the pat on the back from people out there for a good effort, I'll spew up.
From inside the centre square, Boyd's kicked the goal. Boyd's kicked the goal from inside the centre. I can't believe that.
Hey, Pack, welcome to Danny Boyd. It's a podcast about the Footscray Football Club, which is the greatest football club to ever exist. They have won, what, six out of their last seven. They're roaring to the top of the table. I'm Danny McGinlay. He's Tom Boyd.
Mate, it is much easier to justify the statement we are the best football club after the last 7 weeks than it was in the first four. I'll tell you that much. How good a finish was that? I must say, watching the end of that, thinking once Charlie Curnow kicked that goal, I was like, all be over here.
Yep.
And then bang, 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 four quick ones and the game's on our terms.
I've got to say, Carlton played in a very Bulldogsy way. That way where they just couldn't hit a barn door, dominated inside 50s, and then had a bit of an honourable comeback and then to fall short at the end. I feel like that's been our playbook for a lot of this.
Well, we should let the listeners in too, because we are currently sitting in my childhood home.
This
you
is
are
exciting.
Sitting in the exact chair where our guest, Terry Wallace, would have been sitting if he was coaching 10 years later and recruiting me and doing the parent-teacher interviews, as I like to call them. Welcome, mate. Great to have you on board.
Thanks very much, Tom. Danny, that would have been an interesting time, wouldn't it, if I had have been still in the seat back in those days. But I'd well and truly moved on by that time. And, yeah, it is great to be firstly invited onto your podcast, but certainly to be talking about the Bulldogs. Still love the footy club and on a bit of a roll at the moment.
Well, we are sitting in a Carlton household. Every single person in this house barracks for Carlton. Well, my mum's from Denmark, so she didn't have a say in it as they went through the process.
You know, their son won a grand final for the Bulldogs.
Yeah, and my dad grew up in Faulkner, mate. He doesn't listen to any of that
Doesn't that make you just turn? Plough, I heard a rumour from my esteemed colleague Tom Boyd that who do you go for now?
Well,
you got three clubs
It's really difficult when you have a look at it because, I mean, I was, a life member of the Bulldogs. Mm-hmm. I'm also a life member of the Hawthorn Footy Club.
Yeah, premiership player.
And so therefore, and then obviously was involved with Richmond on a couple of occasions as a player for a very, very brief period and then a coach for not much longer. But certainly, from my point of view, I go back to Hawthorn probably more often because of the premierships.
Yep.
Three of those.
You're talking to visit. You physically go back.
Well, reunions, more so than anything else. But I spent longer at the Bulldogs than what I actually spent at Hawthorn. I was 9 years at the Hawks, and I was 14 years actually at the Bulldogs because I played with the Bulldogs and I assistant coached at the Bulldogs, won a reserves premiership with
them.
That's
right.
And then ended up coaching the senior team as well. So there is a big part of me that's still Bulldog.
So when the Dogs play the Tigers in the grand final this year, who will you be? What scarf will you wear?
Oh, that's not even a question mark, that one. Certainly if it was the Dogs and the Tigers, it would be the Bulldogs.
All right.
A little more difficult when it's the Hawks and the Bulldogs, but...
I don't think we're going to run into that issue this year.
Correct. But it did happen once in a semi-final.
It did.
Which was... 2016 season, and
who'd you go for that day? You were working back then.
No, I was actually up in the outer. I was at all four of the finals games. Three of them I worked at, and that was the Friday night game that I didn't have to work on the Friday night, so I just went along with my wife.
Yeah, did you make one of those half scarves they have in soccer?
We were both barracking for the Bulldogs.
Yeah. Well, they'd won three in a row.
Had a crack. It wasn't that difficult on that particular night, but I think everyone who had any sort of form of affiliation with the Dogs was just on the wave.
It was one of the most overwhelmingly positive periods of time in my life. And to your point, I do a lot of work now where I meet all different groups of people for the first time, and often the question gets posed, have we got any Bulldogs here? And if I'm not west of Melbourne, their answer is no,
yep,
categorically. But that week it felt like there would have been, you know, half of each room that I would be in now would have been filled with Bulldog supporters or people who at least had jumped on the bandwagon. Yeah. You know, the grand final parade was probably the best representation of it. It was just a sea of red, white and blue and a couple of, you know, pesky swans here and there. but it was a great time. So 14 years, when did you start at the Bulldogs?
So my first year was 1988.
Yep.
And my final year was 2002, so...
That, to me, that sort of strikes me as probably the biggest period of time where football kind of went from being semi-pro to professional. Is that
yeah?
Was it, how much did it change in that sort of 14-year period?
Well, so I wouldn't think the Doug Hawkins era, when I first arrived, was anywhere near quite close to semi-pro. I think very amateurish, I would have thought, was probably the right words. But I felt probably by the time that I was senior coaching was when the real flip over was starting to happen. So I'm talking 97, we started having players. We'd have two groups of training through the pre-season, those who had to work still and those that was transitioning, those that were transitioning into full-time. So the workers would come in first thing of the morning.
They must have been so bitter.
knock over their training session, and then the others would train more like, yeah, you would have trained in your day, but you're splitting.
Wow.
You're splitting the group in half to be able to do that. So,
who was our first full-time player?
Oh, very good question. Thank you. It'd be the 97 year.
Surely so Chris Grant.
It'd be one of, you know, Grant, West, though. So, although Westy was, no, I don't think it would have been Westy. Probably Granty might have been one of the very early ones, yeah.
It must have been exciting just getting the first one going, but hey, you know your job, you don't have to go. It's the dream.
Yeah, so like we had a lot of players, you know, Matthew Croft and all that crew that were still very, very heavily involved in their work. So, you know, just trying to juggle the two when it was becoming that way. I think by the time we got to 2000, the Sydney Olympics were on in 2000, and that's when a lot of the coaches...
Yeah, I've heard you talk about this.
Yeah, started to become really full. And I'm talking about not just the senior coach who was full-time, but assistants started to become full-time. There was more done on the transition game. And the game started to change, really started to change, I think, personally, in about 2000.
Yeah, did you go up to watch specifically soccer and hockey to see how they, you know, transitioned from offense to defense and things like that?
Yeah, very much. So I'd come from a basketball background, so I was – used to transitional games or more transitional games than what footy was as a set position game, but certainly went to the Olympics, and hockey was the main one that I was watching, just about how they held the ball, got them all back, then held the ball up, even went laterally until the forwards,
waiting
for the numbers to get back forward again. So, yeah, it was a time of change in the game. Now, some will say that wasn't great change. Others will sort of say, well, it was an inevitable change. And I'm more of the case, I suppose, having coached and not being completely old school, that it was inevitable it was going to happen. It's surprising to me that it took so long to occur.
Yeah. Well, because the great story, I mean, probably this is the reason why it happened, actually, is what you just said. But the age-old story is Alistair Clarkson watching soccer to work out how they played that zone. And zoning sort of, instead of playing on a man, you're basically playing on space. And that probably had to be a response to the transition style of footy, because when I was going through the junior ranks, so 2012-13, into my draft year, transition footy wasn't trained particularly hard at the junior level.
Yeah.
But I remember Nathan Robat, an ex-Bulldog of ours, who came back to speak to us at Vic Metro at the time, and he was playing his first season. I played in a national championship with him the year before.
Yep.
And he said, all we do is handball games. It's so hard. Like, all we do is transition, like, half-ground drills with 5-on-5, and that's all they're training us to do. And we all started, you know, sweating about our futures of being punished. But – That was a huge component. And I think, you know, Alistair Clarkson's zone footy was probably a response to the fact that if you couldn't transition in defense, you'd run out of legs and you needed to basically conserve energy.
If I could just add a little bit to that, I can remember the 2008 season, round one, they played Melbourne and
Hawthorn playing Melbourne.
Played Melbourne, and I can remember looking at the vision and stopping the vision and going downstairs and grabbing all our assistant coaches and go, gentlemen, you might want to come up the stairs and have a look at this vision, because I think we've got a distinct change to the game. Melbourne couldn't handle it at all. By 100 points. And it was brought in my opinion, from Clarko. They weren't a good stoppage side.
No.
Up until that year, 2008, every year prior, the side who won clearance, well, clearance was a major score source.
Yep.
The major score source. So whether that's straight directly from centre bounces or ball ups, boundary throw ins around the ground, Hawthorn weren't good at them. So what they sort of said is, we need to put something in behind that score source to get the ball back so that it's not going straight from stoppage, which we're poor at. So we can actually retain the ball back. From 2008 onwards, every single year since, it has been turnover.
Yep.
Score from turnover has been king. So that's how big of a change it was to the game.
And it's so, as a player's perspective, that is so hard to learn, because it's a fundamental difference from when you're a kid, you're taught to play on a man, like to a T, always, and particularly in defence. So to have not only, you know, you're trying to teach 18 players to reference each other instead of the opposition on the field, it's very hard to do. And then, you know, we came into a similar thing where the next evolution for that for us was essentially this really ambitious and aggressive defence where we would play in front and you'd be in the most uncomfortable position, but that made guys like Easton Wood and Jason Johannesson thrive because there was no barrier between them. And to your point, score off turnover was where we really dominated. But we also played Melbourne, who tried to adopt that the next year in pre-season, and they were horrible at it because you don't just get to learn it. It takes 1,000 mistakes over pre-season and in-season to work it out. And it was a fickle thing that we could only keep going for a short period of time with the right personnel who could play that way really effectively.
Yeah. And in fairness, I'll be the first to sort of say, when I was coaching Richmond, we didn't have anyone there at the time. The club was pretty broke. We didn't have anyone there at the time that had come from a Hawthorn, and that's why so many assistant coaches were being plucked from Hawthorn, because that's where it had initiated. Yeah. And so they had trained it up more than anyone else. We didn't have anyone from there. When I finally left the club, sacked. When I finally left the club and Dimmer come in the following year, I've spoken to some of the Richmond boys and they sort of said it was like just training a completely new game and a new game style sort of thing. So where I thought I was on cutting edge of things as a younger coach at the Bulldogs, I thought, you know, perhaps got left behind a little bit, and that's how quickly the game flips and changes around. Probably got left a little bit behind in the second stint at the Tigers.
Yeah, it's like the internet. Like, it was like the invention of the internet. It was like, if you were young enough to pick it up, it's the best thing ever.
Yep. Yes.
And if you weren't, good luck.
Well, I think the second time around I was in the good luck category.
Well, yeah, can we just go back to your playing days? Because I remember you came on the front bar where I worked behind the scenes. You told a brilliant story of the first day you played for the Bulldogs. I think we were playing out at Waverley.
Yeah, correct.
And so you got your wife to drive you?
Yeah, so 1988. I arrived at the Bulldogs on the Thursday night. Weird how the game is back then, those days. So I arrived at the Bulldogs on the Thursday night before round one. So I had a 45-minute run around the park with the lads. And then
a few mates.
I knew Brian Royal and I knew the ones that played Hawkins, state, Doug Hawkins, and I knew Stevie Wallace, who I'd played on a little bit. So I knew those. Got Rick Kennedy as the captain of the club. But Zeno Tatsaris, Dickie Cousins, Richard Cousins, who went on to play a bit, but he was only very, very young back at that stage. Yep. Angelo Petraglia. There was a few of those that I wasn't quite so sure of. So on the Saturday, so basically Thursday night, 45 minutes into a quick team meeting. In those days, I not much involvement. Yeah, so it's a pretty quick team meeting. And then your Friday off. Saturday, I'm driving to Waverley or going to drive to Waverley. I still don't know half the players. So I got my wife to drive the car out and had the team poster out, just making sure that I was swatting on the way to the game so that if one of them got the ball in the back line, Greg Eppleston got the ball, I could actually call his name and try to get a kick. So that's the way that first game played out. And
how often did you yell, mate? In that game.
Oh, there would have been a few. There would have been a bit, mate.
Yeah, it's a bit different to knowing their faces in the car next to your wife than there is when you've just run 5Ks to
get out. I suppose at least it allowed me to go into the locker room and say hello to a few extra people.
Yeah. So how come you only got didn't you do pre-season? When were you approached by the Dogs? Did someone see you at the pub? Or?
Yeah, very late. I did all pre-season with Richmond, and Richmond were broke, and they were mucking me around a little bit. I was training with the extras, not the senior group. Yeah. I was 12 months off being vice captain of a premiership side.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I now find myself with the under-19s and the leftovers on the scrap heap at Richmond 12 months later. They wanted to get out of a pretty substantial contract, and they thought if they mucked me around, that might work, and it did. I just wanted to play.
Yeah, fair enough.
And it was the year of the bicentennial, and so I quit Richmond. They didn't play me in their first of the night series.
As I used Foster's to be Cup, I think it was back then.
Yeah, back in those days, and I just went, well, this is ridiculous.
Yep.
They were bottom of the ladder.
So broke. That was the Save Our Skins campaign.
Correct. The following season was the Save the Skins campaign. Yep. So
it was good times.
So
it didn't work that well because I went to the Fighting Tiger Fund issue like 20 years after this.
So basically, I left, didn't have a club to go to, but the Bicentennial was on that year, and I was going over to represent the Bicentennial for the VFA because what you're allowed to do was, it was place of origin. So Jason Dunster went back and played with Queensland.
Yeah, okay.
Rodney E went back and played with Tassie.
Yep.
If you were an amateur player, so Simon Beasley went back and played with the Australian Amateurs.
Beasley was amateur.
Originally, an amateur boy.
Oh, okay, originally. Yeah.
And so, yes. Yeah, so
I thought for a second we weren't paying one of the best forwards of all time.
You would have had to pay Simon. Yeah. I can guarantee that. So I went back and played with the VFA and won the medal over there, but didn't have a club. And
that's
so
hilarious.
This is crazy. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
So Bulldogs, in their last practice game, lost Steve Wallace with injury. And
is that when he broke his leg?
And Michael McLean. Not sure. No, I don't think it was. But, Michael McLean with the injury. So two midfielders. They needed to stock up with a midfielder, and I got a call up. So
it is the quintessential story of always be ready. You know, like just got to be ready to put your hand up when something happens. It's like what they tell every VFL player. And this is obviously a very strange story to me, thinking about not having a club but playing representative footy. It's like, who are you representing?
Yeah.
You just always have to be ready to go when they.
And the fortunate thing for my, I suppose, Bulldogs and mine was that I had done all the pre-season. So it wasn't as if you're coming off nothing.
So how long was between when you finished up at Richmond and then played that game? A few weeks?
Probably a month, Bicentennial Carnival went for, like, we played three games in a week, which is good fun as well.
It's good when you're young. Like, when I loved it when I was 16.
Yeah, it was great for me. I was 29. Not so good, but it filled in the void, and to do a couple of weeks by myself wasn't a real major issue. So
88-89, not great years for the Dogs. 1990, you have a bit of a turnaround, like the fight back and bringing in Terry Wheeler, and like Libba won the Brownlow that year. 91, you only played half the year. Now we're gonna go down some dark paths here in the show plow, and this is a very personal one. I got my first Bulldogs jumper, proper one, not hand me down, when I was 8, and I waited a year to pick a number, and then I picked 16. And you retired 91. You retired the next day, you prick. I cried. It was in the newspaper, everything.
Do your research, Danny.
It was shocking.
Well,
No, I waited.
I'm thinking the parents should be saying to somebody, if you want to have that number for a few years, yes, you don't pick a 31-year-old. No. Well, I might have a 32-year-old. Yeah.
Parents were migrants. They had no idea. But then I became a Matthew Croft fan.
Well, so. Very good. And Crofty, what a great player he was for the footy club. Yeah, so I was 88, 89, 90. I won the two best and fairest Charlie Sutton medals in 88 and 89. Yep. Had a really good year in 1990. Got to the 250th game in 1990 and thought I'd play probably to the 300.
Yep.
And played about six more. Had knees all, just a knee problem all through really? The summer. Couldn't get it right. Was trying to play half fit. We had other blokes that were ready to go. Simon Atkins had come through and
he was good.
Playing pretty good footy. So I just thought, the club had done the right thing for me. It was my time was up to move.
Probably because you were playing three games a week at 29, Terry.
Probably didn't help along the journey, and had about six operations on one knee by that stage. Yeah. Anyway,
When did you go to coaching? Like, obviously, you start. I know you're the senior coach halfway through '96. Yeah. Did you go straight to like assistant coaching? Did you hang around the club, or did you have some time off?
Yeah, well, I was one who had. Working corporate background, and had thought if I was ever going to go into footy, it was more likely to be into footy management than actually into the coaching side of things. But I was state sales manager of Sky Channel, which is satellite TV, which was Kerry Packer owned out of GTV9.
Okay.
So I ran that in Victoria for 9 or 10 years.
Whilst you're playing, or?
So it was last couple of years of playing,
yep,
and then into assistant coaching. And then once the assistant coaching senior coaching role come up, obviously I had to make a decision between the two and left to go full time.
What did assistant coaching look like back then? Because at the moment, like, they're probably the unsung heroes of the, like, what makes those footy clubs work, because they're vastly overworked.
Yeah.
And they don't get paid that well.
Yeah.
What was it like for you back at that stage? You're obviously working two jobs.
Yeah. So I would say that my assistant coaching role would have given me about half of what my employment would have given me at the time.
Yeah.
But it was part time, that wasn't a bad little mix between the two. You were betwixt between. Because you're wanting to be down the club as much as what you possibly could, to be putting as much effort in to make sure that you were doing the right thing there, but you had a full-time job at the same time. The amount of times our head office was in Sydney. Sydney and VFL, AFL football didn't have much to do with each other at all. And the amount of times that you'd be just about to walk out the door at work and some very important call would come through and you try to sort of juggle, get them off the phone quick enough so you could get down the road. It was difficult. I would say when I got to senior coaching, that's when assistant coaching went full-time. And it was a much better structured arrangement.
Were you watching film, or like, what was that? Like, was it more the hands Betamax on footy coach? You know what I mean? Like,
so when I was assistant coaching, it was, you were just coaching.
Yeah.
Very limited. Yeah, there was footage, but very limited footage.
Back in those days,
like now we're spoiled. We're watching 9 games every weekend if you want to.
Yeah, yeah.
But 9 games every weekend, back then you would get maybe 30 to 40 minutes of the main game and 20 minutes of two games split. That's all that you got availability for. So it was very, very hard to, and if you were trying to have a look at a lesser light team, you've got no footage on them whatsoever. So very, very hard to do much analysing. The opposition analysis was very, very difficult.
Did you still tape it, like, off the TV, off Channel 7? You have to fast forward through the ad breaks?
I think we had, was it Betacords or Betamax?
Betamax, that's
back in those days. So, but, and then once again, everything that sort of aligned with the, more vision being available when the full-time coaching came. Sure. So it was almost this thing around the late 90s where more vision available, more time available,
more money,
more coaching time available, more money available, and it really did take a big step up. Bulldogs were one of the real early initiative teams, because I mean, I was getting sent over as an assistant coach and a coach to America before, you know, I mean, you now, yeah, you're Clarko's going over there, spending 6 months over there if he wants to, but there wasn't much of that going on. And we were one of the real early clubs to actually take that initiative up.
Yeah, I do know there's an awesome story coming up. I want to try and do this chronologically with your career, but I know America had an unsung role in one of the best Bulldogs victories of all time that we will get to. Should we go the... I mean,
he's been doing his homework, hasn't he?
Yep. He actually, when I called him earlier today, I said, what are you doing? He goes, working, mate. I said, what are you working on? Researching Terry.
Just watching some old games and stuff. All right, let's... like you are on this podcast every week, you do realise. In the intro, I've got some great little moments of commentary and Ted Whitten giving his thing, Boydie's kicked a goal, and of course...
let me guess. Yeah. It wouldn't be a spew-up moment, would it?
It would be a spew-up moment. Which Bob Murphy has famously said is one of the great sprays because it's anger, it's passion, but it's really positive because it's you telling them you're better than this, you've got the ability. It's what? How did you like? How improvised was it?
About 15 metres before the boundary line, before we go down the race. Turned around to Gordon Casey, was on our match committee, and I turned around to him and just sort of said, I think we've had enough of this. And we're just close losses. We'd been around the mark, around the mark, around the mark.
Yes, honourable losses.
That game, we they kicked 7 in the first quarter. We won the 3 quarters after that, lost by 2 points. Yeah. So, yeah, I just said, well, surely we've had enough. And I'd been kid gloves on with the boys because of the fact that, I was the one who was wrapping the arm around him. We'd had a change of coach.
I'd been the
assistant coach. I coached a lot of the boys in the reserves to the reserves premiership. So I'm talking Brad Johnson, a reserves player, Rowan Smith as a reserves player when they were kids.
Yeah.
So I was...
Hey, were you good cop to Alan Joyce's bad cop?
I think. I think in those days that was the case. But then you get the role...
Yeah.
Well, you've got to make a decision. Can you stay good cop or are you going to become bad cop? So that was the first day that I went, no, I've got to take some form of real control of where this is going. So
that entire year, you've got a camera crew following you around making the Year of the Dogs documentary.
Not my decision. Everyone would think that would be my decision. Because
I've never heard of a coach who wants cameras following him around.
So. I've never been shy in front of a camera, but no, that was certainly something that was organised before I took on the role. And it was very awkward for Joycey. Because Joycey was the opposite. Really from the old school of, we don't give anything to anyone. Yeah. So I think it was pretty uncomfortable for him. It didn't really worry me much. But people kept sort of saying, oh, did you play it for the camera or did you do it for the camera? You didn't even, because you were...
Yeah, when they're there all the time.
The whole time.
Yeah.
Me and the assistant coaches would tell a dirty joke in the middle of the ground while the boys are warming up, and we'd have to go, oh, sorry, Michael Cordell, the guy was running,
audio,
because he's got all the audio going. So you didn't realise.
Man, have you watched Year of the Dog, Boydie?
I don't think so. No,
we got to do a watching party with the fans and everything. So look, we've got listener mail on a few things, and of course, one is the spew up moment. I do want to know one of my favourite questions I got from this is from Bede, because you say, I'll spew up, and then you said, all right, I'll see you back at the social club for a beer. How was the vibe at the social club?
Look, the vibe was actually always pretty good down there, and that was half of our issue a little bit, because there was a little bit of an acceptance of, near enough, good enough.
Okay.
And I very much felt that when I first arrived, particularly from the Hawthorn side of things. I might have veered past Punt Road for 12 months, but, all my recollections and memories were Hawthorn, where... Yeah, if you were 3 or 4 goals down at three-quarter time, it was who's going to lift to get you over the line.
Yep.
Where the Bulldogs, if you were sort of close to one of the good sides, it was like pats on the back and congratulations, which was hence the if anyone gets a pat in the back.
Did anyone get a pat in the back?
I don't think so.
Okay, good.
I think they heard me through the walls.
It is a choice though, like that, especially when you get, and I don't know the demographic of the team. I wasn't alive just yet, or maybe I was just born.
You were 1 year old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is like a significant mental milestone to get to the point where you win those close games. Yeah. And it's very difficult for coaches to work out exactly which button to push, but did it work?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. We certainly, it wasn't instantaneous.
No.
But we certainly, from that moment onwards, we had a different look at ourselves. We expected to be able to compete against the best sides for the rest of that year, which was the 96 year where I was interim coach. We didn't win that many, which wasn't the flip over that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But it was competitive in every game. First half of the year, we'd been getting beaten by 10, 12 goals, 14 goals. So by the end of 96, we knew we could compete at the level, and if we did a few things, we tricked up a few, brought a few people in, we thought we could take on the competition the next year, which is exactly the way it played out.
It Bevo had a slightly different tactic post-2015, which was to rewatch the entire Adelaide final. Play by play, it took about 4 hours, and I must say I've never been happier to not play in a final than those 4 hours, because at least I wasn't getting shown up on train. Because I tell you what, like, it was to the granular detail of
Why did you do that? Talia could have just texted you what happened.
that's a bit of a sore point.
Okay, play on.
Not with me, but let's just say that caused more than a few arguments. It actually created one of the greatest rivalries between a coach and a certain person in the media that's ever existed.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Very much so.
But that was his approach.
I've worked with both.
So what did you do then in that season? Because
Bevo was in my reserve premiership team.
Oh, really?
You
coached the premiership coach to a premiership. This is inception. But what did you? The difference between 96 and 97 was chalk and cheese. First of all, how did you react to David Smorgon coming in and going, by the way, we've got a different name, which is still a bugbear of mine?
No, I was okay because it was sold correctly, and David could sell things. I mean, he was very, very good in that area. And I suppose corporately, was my background as well. So I could get the fact that if we could encompass, rather than being landlocked, where you've sort of got Geelong, who controlled everything that was coming up the highway, you had Essendon on one side of us, you had North Melbourne on the other side
surrounded.
Of us. We really just had, Footscray, Yarraville, Braidwood. That was about it. The whole idea was, the West is growing and it's growing at a rapid rate. If we could incorporate all that, it might be survival. Well, I'd been there enough to see what the other side of it looked like when it didn't look like surviving. So whatever it took to me for the club to survive was the most important thing. So I didn't have any problem with that. I didn't have any problem with the new group coming in because it had got a little bit tired, and Peter Gordon was the president that was on the way out at that stage. He had done a bloody brilliant job and saved the footy club. Saved them a couple of times, but things happen, and he'd put all his energies into saving the thing, and then it was still just chugging along.
He's so a wartime leader.
So they just needed some injection of some new money and some new blood. To get in there.
Get
in there and get amongst it.
So what did you do over that summer? I know famously you started the preseason a lot earlier.
Yep.
Did you target any specific players in the draft or in the trade period?
Not particularly. We almost went in with the same group. There was a couple that come in. We had Paul Hudson
come
in. So Simon come in first.
Yep.
And Simon and Paul are cousins.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So what happened was that Simon sort of said, I think there's a chance that Paul's a little disgruntled at Hawthorn. We might be able to sort of work on
that
one.
He was great, Paul Hudson.
He was brilliant for us. So
it was back in the day when players had choice.
Yes, correct. So
I hear he's a bit disgruntled. So he's got a 4-year deal. What are you going to do about it?
So we brought a couple in, but it was still more the group that we had before, a few which I'd played with.
Yeah.
So I had, you know, Scotty Wine that I'd played with.
Libba.
Obviously, Libba I'd played with. Granty and Leon Cameron were there in that 1990 season. So I played with them, 90 and 91, even though you didn't see me when you're wearing your jumper in 91. But so there was a few that I'd coached, mostly that I'd, sorry, that I'd played with, but mostly that I'd coached at sort of reserve grade level, sort of coming together. First thing I did was put all their names up on a wall.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And just went and put everything that they'd done from the time that they were junior footballers. So best and fairest that they'd won, you know, representing of Teal Cup as it was back in those days, which is the under-18 championships for those that don't know. Put all their records up. And I sort of said, the rest of the world see you as 15th in the competition. The 16th side had dropped out, which was
Fitzroy.
Yeah. They'd become the Lions. So we, for in all purposes, were the worst side in the competition. I said, the competition sees you as the worst side. That's what I see you as.
Oh, that's like, good.
Just, you know, that's
full, a one-liner, isn't it?
That's the full wall of how I see you. So you can see yourself any way you want to see you. But I'm treating it, I'm going to act as if that's who you are as a group. And we just went about our work. And we had – no one had balls out before Christmas back in those days.
Like, yeah.
Why you – I used to sort of say, well, there's a tennis player go and just run 400s and
– imagine telling basketballers that, given your background. Like, crazy. Yeah, don't shoot before Christmas. Okay. Why? Yeah. Well, isn't the whole point to get the ball in the hoop?
So I was sitting there sort of saying, well, skill level needs to come up. We're going to work on, you know, skills. We were very early transitional games.
Yep.
So we were probably the first club to start doing all those transitional games. And so we tried to get a leg up and what others were doing, and we probably went almost too hard, but we were coming from so far back. North Melbourne won the premiership the year before, and it was everywhere you read, it was they had worked their way through the season, started slowly, like some of the sides do.
Geelong last year.
Yeah, last year. Started slowly and built themselves towards something in the back half of the year. So my thinking was that everyone would follow the leader, which is a leader-followed industry.
Yes.
So everyone would probably start slow. So we'll go the opposite way.
Yep.
So we'll be ready for grand final in round one and see whether we can get a jump on them. And by the time we get to 6 or 7 weeks in, we might just get ourselves
momentum
going sort of that way. And that's pretty much how it played out.
I know you said it in jest before about him coaching a premiership coach to be a premiership coach.
Yeah.
But a lot of the philosophies that you have are very similar with Bevo. You know, massive when he first got to the footy club going, I don't care what position you've played in previously, I'm here to play you in the position that I think suits you the best. Liam Pickett is the easiest, not most obvious example. You've been a tagger for 5 years, turns into an incredibly prolific midfielder, winger.
And what about the forward role of the grand final?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The other one was that Bevo also walked into the club, and I remember basically so vividly him essentially saying, look, you guys are all fit enough and strong enough. Like, you need to learn to play football together, and you need to learn to play football the way that I want you to play. And so all we did was play scratch matches, transition games, handball games. Like, the balls were out in every single drill. We stopped running. Like, you know, there was the whole Dunkley thing at the start of the year where he said, oh, the Dogs don't run that much. It's because we don't do blocks of running, or we didn't do blocks of running for an hour like most clubs do.
Yep.
We used to do very, very difficult training drills with running shuttles in between the drills and so on and so forth. So you'd be always under fatigue when you were training. But all of that stuff sounded very familiar to listen to you.
It's funny, in the premiership, reserves premiership year, like Luke
had played. This is 95?
Luke had played a lot of senior football. I think
94.
93, 94. Luke had played a lot of senior footy by that stage. Yeah, it was 94. So, and so he was sort of coming to the end of his time, but a really good foot soldier, you know, really sort of senior player, was fantastic for the kids coming through and teaching them the right way to go about it. So where do you reckon we played him in our side?
Ruck.
Back pocket.
Ruck.
No way, ruck.
Truly. If you think about any level of football, if you haven't got a good ruckman,
yep.
So what we had was we had a young kid who was learning his trade, a guy by the name of Zvonimir Suto.
Okay.
And so we would tap ruck him and then just let Luke go and play as the fourth.
He didn't do the tap outs, but he did everything else.
Correct. Ah. So the fourth, yeah. So he go and play as a fourth on baller. So at that level, he's playing against, you know, a lightly framed 18-year-old ruckman who'd get the ball four times a game.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just running around as the extra midfielder getting 35 times.
I'm going to add this to the list of things that you put into Luke's categories, which is playing midfielders in the ruck.
Did he get the equivalent of the Norm Smith?
He was dominant. He was. We had a few pretty handy players come back into that side. We had Steve McPherson and Simon Atkins were the.
Because there was a weird rule: if you played enough reserves games, you could go back. So you could top up our. Because we had an okay year, but yeah. I think through a few injuries, Simon Atkins was one of the. In 1992, one of the probably should have got the Brownlow if it wasn't for Scott Wynd.
Yeah. So we had some very good and very senior players in that reserve side. But Lukey used to run around as the ruckman.
So 97, we do start the game. I mean, we lose the first game to Freo, but then it's just onwards, like just a brilliant season. There's a bit of a dip to around the three-quarter mark of the season, but then we come good in finals. We win our first final against the Swans
comfortably,
smash them as well. And now we've got to get to the dark part, the worst day of all of our lives, 97 prelim. Boydie, I don't know how much you've had to – you were two. I'm sure you cried that day just by law of averages.
Yeah, it was a good year. My wife was born in 97.
So oh, there we go.
Yeah, yep. It was good things that came out of it.
It was brilliant. I remember at three-quarter time, I was sitting behind the goals at the City End with a whole bunch of other teenage Bulldogs fans from the northern suburbs, and very arrogantly, one of us did say, "Do you know what, boys? I'll go line up at the ticket booth. If we get the first goal, I'll go and line up at the ticket booth and start the line for grand final tickets."
So you're the reason.
No, he is. I didn't say it. But I did remember a guy behind us went, "Don't say that, boys. Don't say that." And we're like, "All right, come on, mate. Hey, let's all enjoy this." Yeah. I mean, Libba did kick that winning goal. I was right behind it. I saw it happen. Let's just... Libba on McLeod. Why wasn't Chris Grant at centre half back? What happened in your memory of it?
A lot happened. So we were four up.
Four goals up. We were
four goals up at three quarter time in a prelim final. Should be able to hold on. Should be able to win from there. If we kick two for the quarter, let's say we kick two for the quarter, they're going to kick seven or eight to get up and beat you. It was the only quarter one other quarter. So we played Port Adelaide before the bye mid-season.
Oh, at Optus Oval in the pouring rain.
Yeah. And
their first win in Melbourne.
And didn't kick a goal in one quarter. It was the only quarter that we hadn't kicked a goal in for the season.
Yep.
Until the last quarter of the prelim final. And we kicked 0-6.
Mark West missed a sitter.
0-6 to go down. So if we kick a couple, and Libba's was a goal.
Correct.
But unfortunately, that's part of footy folklore. But if we kick one, we probably win. But if we kick a couple, we're home.
We're good.
We had ample opportunities, ample opportunities. We still tightened. There's no doubt. They come at us. We still tightened. If I had my time over again, would have I thrown Granty back? Yeah, I would have.
Yep.
Yeah, no doubt I would have. But I still thought that one goal would be enough. Yeah, and then we get to 90 seconds left to play. We get control of the ball. We run it inside forward 50. We're 30 metres out directly in front. And we kick a point. If we kick the goal, we're 8 points in front. Back in those days, could have flooded everyone back.
Yeah, yep.
And they couldn't beat us with 90 seconds to go with two goals to get. We miss it. They go coast to coast, kick the goal down the other end, and the game's over. So so that's how close it was. It was Yeah, it was bloody tragic.
It was so awful. Yeah, all right.
How long left when Libba kicked that goal that was called a point?
Oh, it was plenty of time. So that was seven.
Yeah, okay.
Seven,
right.
Early days, but it was enough to break them psychologically. Yeah. It sounds like
this, the also, psychological slippery slide of that last quarter.
But I'll go the other way. I'll go back to, and sorry, Bulldogs people, but just when I was with Hawthorn at one stage and we played a grand final where we were four up in 85.
Oh, yes.
And it played Essendon. When Essendon kicked that goal and all of a sudden they realised they were going to win, what it did for their players and what it did for the supporter base and what it did to the MCG was enormous. If we kicked the goals, particularly with Adam and Libba, if we kicked the goal, everyone there, like, there was a good core of Adelaide people, but everyone else was willing us to win the game. They would have lifted the roof off the joint, and I think that would have been enough. And, you know, Tom, you think back to that premiership victory, how you feed off the noise and the exhilaration and everything. I mean, you can actually really get energy out of that. We just couldn't get anything that grew our energy in that last quarter of the prelim final.
Yeah, and when things are slipping out of your hands, it's a horrible feeling. And you can feel it happening, and what takes – generally speaking, in those moments, is someone to stand up and just do something that is completely against the grain, which would have been that goal, obviously.
Yeah.
And then to your point, that's when it, you know, that's when you break the opposition because they've tried so hard and now it's still two kicks away.
Yeah, they did. It was Darren Jarman.
It was. He was amazing. But I don't want to. All right, just one last question on 97.
We recruited his nephew in the end, didn't we? Declan Hamilton was his nephew.
Oh, was that his nephew? Yeah. I didn't know that.
I think so.
I think he played a game.
It's still not helping me.
No. And he didn't play a game for us either.
I'm so sorry, Terry. But one last question on 97. Yep. How much would we have beaten the Saints by the next week?
We would have beaten. Yeah,
oh,
we,
I know.
We'd beaten them both times we played them for the year. They'd had a really harsh run in. They'd lost their three ruckmen. Lazar, Vidovic and Everett Spider.
See, look, you still know all this stuff. Yeah,
they lost those. They had a tragedy inside the four walls within the week, which really devastated a lot of people down there. So
that Trevor Barker?
That had occurred. So there was a lot going down. And so I think we would have handled them.
And when you'd got the Premier's, the Jock McHale medal, which injured player would you have given it to?
Well, we had a few sitting on the sidelines at the times as well. So
Jose Romero had a dodgy rib,
I don't think Jose would have played. If we had made the grand final, I don't think Jose would have played.
So like to call Jose to the podium.
He would have been the one.
All right, we're running out of time and we haven't even got to your best achievement. Let's talk about the year 2000.
I thought you were talking about my children.
I thought you were going to talk about the list manager, you know, or doing future stars with me.
Bringing Tom Voider. The year 2000, we have these very weird 3 weeks, Tom, where it's 2 weeks before the Essendon game, we knock off Carlton, who were also, if not undefeated, very close, had only dropped one game. Yep. It's Bob Murphy's
10
first
in a
game.
Row,
yeah. And it's at Optus Oval.
Yep.
And it's Bob Murphy's first game.
Yep.
He always says he didn't kick the winner because there was another goal afterwards. He kicked the winner. It was awesome.
Yeah, yep.
It was a wobbler too.
On his opposite as well?
It was on his right.
And then Essendon play Carlton the week after, which was revenge for the 99 prelim for them. And you get a sniff that, all right, Essendon have just played their prelim. They think we're easy beats. And going back to America, the Denver Broncos had a say in this amazing flooding tactic.
Yeah, well, I went over to Denver with the Broncos, but it was actually at Jacksonville with the Jaguars, where they have their parties outside, the tailgate parties,
it's a party town, apparently.
Yeah, so we all wander in with an hour before the game, we wander into our seats, they're all out at barbecues outside.
Yeah, brilliant.
So that
because they can't get a beer after halftime.
So they get tanked before they go in.
True story.
So the place is empty when you're there, and so I had carte blanche for a week to be able to go. Went to Denver first and then went to Jacksonville. But game day at Jacksonville, we're up on the stadium floor and I'm watching the quarterback out there and throwing the ball, you know, the length of the ground, and the big blockers, you know, using the bags and doing their work, and, you know, the running backs sort of doing their stuff, getting themselves ready to go. And I went, how come for 120, 150 years we've been inside a little room jogging up and down on the spot, kicking the ball, you know, 5 metres to each other, trying to do this? Why aren't we going out in the ground and doing exactly what they're doing? It makes so much sense. And back in those days, blokes were doing hammies in the start, like first quarter hammies were just a religion. We expect them to kick the 60-metre goal when they've only kicked the ball 5 metres in a room to each other in the first quarter. So blokes are tearing their hamstrings apart. So I come back to the boys and sort of said, look, this is what I've seen. I think we should put it in place. I think it'd be well worth our while. Save injury, save a few problems, get your eye in. Had a few guys, the doubters, the naysayers, sort of, well, what happens if it's wet? We get wet. I said, I'll make sure we've got two sets of jumpers. You can go and have a shower and put on a fresh jumper. I think that side of it will be all right.
You're going to get wet one way.
Correct. Plus, yeah, then you practice what you need to be doing out there for 2 hours anyway. Yeah. So that's what we did. And we had a little bit of trouble getting it through the AFL.
Yep.
Ian Collins was there at the time.
It's so crazy looking back now and thinking that this was like a question mark.
Well, they wouldn't let us because they wouldn't put the reserves on because the reserves were on beforehand. They wouldn't put them on half an hour early because they would have to pay all the staff
an extra
half hour
for
their time. And so I went back to him because we were playing at Carlton's old ground then. So I went back to him and sort of said, well, you've got a problem because – I've got it organised with the council that we're actually going to go out and do our warm-up out in Princes Park 1. Yeah. So now what you're going to have is once our supporters know, they're not going to come in, so you're going to have a rush on the gates because they want to see the players and
be close with the players.
Wow.
Plus then you've got security issues
about the players going in,
players going out. Within an hour, he rang back and said, okay, you got me.
This is great.
So we got our way and all the other clubs went, this is rubbish, you know, show ponies and just trying to put on, you know, something different. That was 1998, the start of 98. By the time we were, I think, 8-1 at the start of the year and we were blitzing sides in the early part of games. By halfway through the year, virtually every side was doing it. By the end of the year, every single side in the competition was doing it. It's been done every year since 1998. Wow.
Did you have skill-specific training like the Denver Broncos did back then, or was that kind of a new concept as well, like training people in the, you know, the midfielders train with the midfielders and so on and so forth?
We very much got that from going over. And that's where I sort of said the Bulldogs were right at the front of the initiatives of going overseas and looking at what others were doing. And there was a share of information and we had others go across there because, in Florida, it was very much a very similar dynamic to the Western suburbs.
Yep.
And so we had our welfare people go over and sort of see what they were doing in comparison to what we were doing. So, they're pretty progressive.
No one has ever called the Bulldogs progressive until this moment.
We had to be to survive.
Yeah.
But didn't you ask, in those days that you're at Jacksonville, you sort of showed some of their coaches how the game works and said, come up with a strategy. Oh,
that was Denver.
Denver? Yeah, okay. So you'll love this, Boydie. Yeah.
So what we did in Denver, we went to their coaching staff and they had a half day off, but they were prepared to give us their time. And we sort of went through vision of the game and sort of said, this is the Aussie rules game. This is how we play. Some of them had seen it. Some of them knew very, very little. This is how we play. I'm not going to tell you how we structure up, but here's our 18 players. You tell us how you would set it up after watching the vision of the game, how you would set up play. And it was fascinating to have a look at. So they went, okay, we'd have three down forward. We'd structure everyone basically behind the football.
Yeah.
And we'd give them the edges, but we take complete control and they gridded they basically gridded the ground and said we're controlling the grids, and then when we get the ball back, then we'll transition back like basketball back the other way.
Like a zone.
Yep. Wow. So we come home and we went, okay, we're going to try this. So we painted up, this is pre-season, we painted up the Witten Oval and got the players and did a few training drills on it and sort of see how it went. We played a practice game and trialled it, and it was non-conclusive. It was a typical Witten Oval day.
Windy
as hell. At one end, you were up, so they were trying to bob them 70 metres over the zone. The other end, you couldn't get the ball up there. So it was non-conclusive. So we let it go and sort of said, we'll just park it. Hence, we get to play Essendon in 2020. We've got about
2000.
Round 21. Are there and we're doing match committee. We've got about six out. We're starting to look at our side, and we've got youngsters like a young Mitch Hahn who's played seven games.
Bob's on his third game.
Yeah, and he's going to play on James Hurd.
Yeah.
And we're going, personnel-wise, we couldn't go with him. Personnel-wise, we couldn't go with him. So we sort of said, we'll go to the players. You've got to get imprimatur always, but go to the players and sort of say, you know the stuff that we did over summer, are you prepared to give it a go? And the senior core group went, yep, no one else has been able to get near them.
Yep.
Let's have a crack at it. So I went to the media, not sort of strongly, but just sort of said, look, we're treating Essendon with the respect that they deserve. They haven't been beaten. So we're going to have a light week. It's like our grand final type setup week. We're going to do two skill sessions of 15 minutes and just freshen the boys up so they can come out and have the best crack at the best side that we've perhaps ever seen. And so that's what we did. We'd go and have a little run around on the ground, have a few kicks. All the boys would jump in the car and we'd drive down to Werribee and we'd grid it up the Werribee ground.
Oh, wow.
So we did three.
So no one knew. The media, Essendon Spires, no one thought to go to Werribee.
No one thought to follow a car. And so.
What could they have done anyway? But that would have been a real shock.
At least they would have known what's coming, but they had no idea what we were doing. So we got everyone.
This is awesome.
It's the best.
And to try to get into a bloke's head, and I'll pick him out. I mean, he's a superstar for the footy club, but Scott West was a ball-winning, possession-winning superstar.
Yeah.
To try to tell him that he was going to play on Joe Macedi, and as soon as we lost possession of the ball, he wasn't allowed to play on Joe Macedi. He had to just get back and play like a zone defense in basketball. In basketball, he was mortified, like, about how are we going to do this?
How am I going to get the ball?
And it just was completely – I just said, well, in this game, for one game, you might halve your total numbers – because we're playing just more of a defensive game than an offensive game. So it might halve your numbers, but it might give us a chance of winning. So as soon as I knew I had him in and he went, tick, yeah, I'll tick it off, I knew we'd have all the boys in. And that's the way we played it. And it was very similar to Rope-A-Dope. I don't recall the numbers. I know we had the lowest inside 50 count for any game that season.
Wow.
And they had like numbers in the 70s.
Which would have been extremely high for back then.
Extremely high for back then. And but they couldn't get through, couldn't find a way, couldn't take a mark inside 50. We'd transition up the ground, find open space because everyone had pushed down, find open space, get a goal out the back. But they were still in front. And I always said to the players, at some stage we might have to break it and go back to transition, traditional footy. And we got the stage where we sort of said, if we could stay close, then we'll go after them. And what had happened through the game was, because they had had all the play, they were the ones trying to, how do we get through, push the whole time, they were knackered. Our blokes are like, Muhammad Ali sitting on the ropes, Rope-A-Dope. Our blokes have been just sitting back all game. Scott West was the freshest bloke. He never felt that way in his life. I feel like I played in the back pocket all game. So then when we pulled the trigger at about 12, 15 minutes into the last quarter, Our blokes were fresh, ready to run, ready to go.
We'll be excited for not having to defend anymore.
Correct. Just go and play. Yeah. And you can imagine the runner going around it. Time to play, boys. Off they went and ended up knocking them over.
Did you have a good press conference after that game?
It was fun. Yeah. it was certainly better than the 97 Olympic press conference.
And, man, Essendon fans must be so annoyed. They played a almost perfect season, just one of the greatest sides ever, but that's the only game people remember.
This is the Baby Bombers, right?
They were 93. They were the Baby Bombers, a bit older.
Yeah. That was the only game they lost for the year.
Only game they lost for the year. I mean, they won all their finals by 10 goals. Yeah.
that's awesome.
They genuinely still to this day believe that we cheated them out of the perfect season. Well, hang on a minute. It's a game of football. No matter how it's won.
That sounds like Essendon.
Well, we've barely scratched the surface. We've got almost at the hour mark. We have to get you back, Plough, to do the second half where you scouted a young Tom Boyd and got him on the TV show and
he was a star. He made us.
Yeah, well, you know. I don't know. I'll watch it back later before the next time we do this and just see how I went. I remember just being very – it was very strange because I'd done so much media at that stage. Like, being a guest is easy. Hosting is completely different muscle to use. But anyway.
Mate, I've seen you. You're good at it now.
Yeah, I'm all right.
You're literally doing it as we speak.
Yeah, well, I talk for a living, so it helps.
Well, we didn't even get to the 2016 season. I know. What that meant to like, – so because that meant – the world took, I mean, all doggies all people, but geez, I didn't shed my tear after the grand final. I shed my tear after the prelim.
Mm.
I had a few tears after the prelim.
Bawled like a child, yes.
I was so tired.
All right, it's official. You're coming back. This is part one.
We'll go to the ranch next time.
More than happy to, guys.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Hey, Perth, if you're in Perth, I'm playing the Wreckabyte this Friday. It'd be great to see the Danny Boyd crew there. You can buy Boydie's book. Plough, do you have anything to plug? You're a happily retired man.
I'm a retired man these days. So.
Awesome.
All good.
We're going to plug the 2000 round 21 game against Essendon, which I think the last quarter is on YouTube. So.
Winning cheap.
I gave my childhood to that roar of the red, white and blue sea, and the knowledge that you had to love the Bulldog boys and me. 20 years on, I feel that longing hanging in September air. But the reason I go every week is to pretend you're still there. And they will find the glory one day, and I will throw it at your feet. It's a long, long road they're running for you, the dogs of Footscray Street. Long, long road they're running for you, the dogs of Footscray Streets.